All right. Another test mean that was almost exactly where it should be. So congratulations to the average student. Some of you did better on the second one, which for most people is harder, so that's kind of encouraging. Anyway, time for a new unit. It's a continuation of topic, though, right? Because we're kind of in the middle of the overall process that we call the complete oxidation of a fuel, and we're using glucose as the master fuel, which it is. It's the preferred fuel in nearly all cells. Now it's time, though, to go down one of those two possible pathways at the fork in the road after glycolysis, right? You've already mastered glycolysis. Time now to assume that oxygen is available, and so we're going to look at cellular respiration. And what is it that qualifies cellular respiration as respiration? Glycolysis is not respiration. And this book, and some books actually include it in the process of cellular respiration, I don't. So glycolysis happens no matter what. Cellular respiration either happens or it doesn't, depending on the ability for that cellular respiration to occur after after glycolysis. But what is it that makes it respiration? Right, the pumping of protons. Well, specifically, actually, what qualifies it as respiration is that there is a transfer of electrons from fuel to external electron acceptors. External meaning particles that are added, they're not already part of the pathways. And notice that that didn't happen in fermentation, which is also not respiration. In fermentation, the goal was what? No, that glycolysis makes that happen. Fermentation, the goal in a sense, fermentation accomplishes the reoxidation of NADH into NAD+, right? Well, to oxidize NADH into NAD+, you have to reduce something else, right? In other words, something else has to receive those electrons. Those electrons that NADH was carrying in fermentation, that came from the fuel. But those electrons get put right back onto the fuel, or one of the fuels, right? Which is the pyruvate. That's what converts it into lactate. So pyruvate is not an external electron acceptor. It's part of the pathway. What makes it respiration is those electrons that are stripped from the fuel get passed across a membrane and then eventually end up on an external electron acceptor. That's what respiration is. And recall that there are two kinds of respiration, aerobic and anaerobic. Of course, depending on what the nature of that final electron acceptor is. So aerobic respiration, which is our style, but not the only possibility, uses as that external electron acceptor oxygen, which is almost the only reason you need oxygen. There's a couple other reasons that oxygen is used, but for the most part, oxygen would otherwise be damaging. Okay? But that's why you breathe oxygen, so that it can serve as the final electron acceptor in your version of cellular respiration. There are some prokaryotes that respire, but they use a different electron acceptor compared to oxygen. So that's still respiration because it's still transfer of electrons from fuel through a membrane to an external acceptor, but in that case it's something other than oxygen. Just keep in mind the difference between fermentation, which is anaerobic but not respiration, and anaerobic respiration, which is respiration just not using oxygen. Okay, if that's clear, let's look at slide one, which is a cartoon summary of the complete oxidation of glucose. So that includes more than cellular respiration. When you start with glucose, the first process, of course, is glycolysis, which we've already covered. And as you see in this figure, that occurs in the cytoplasm, outside of the mitochondrion in a eukaryote, right? And there's the 10 steps we've already talked about there. That single 6-carbon glucose is split into 2 3-carbon pyruvates. And some energy thereby is extracted, which is why some ATP is made and some coenzyme is reduced into NADH, NH+, right? So that's where some of that glucose energy is at the moment. It's in ATP, the 2 net ATP that are made for each glucose from glycolysis, and ATP is ATP, so it doesn't need to be further processed. You know, when you think about ATP as the goal of this whole process, that ATP that glycolysis spits out, that's done. It's already in the usable form. NADH is storing some energy that can be used to make about 3 ATP on its own. Or it's carrying enough energy to eventually produce another 3 ATP. So that's another major source of, another major place where some of that glucose energy originally now is. But a lot of the energy that was originally in that glucose is still in the fuel, which is not completely spent yet. That's what pyruvate you should think of. It is partially spent fuel because the carbon skeleton has only been partially dismantled and partially dehydrogenated. There's still carbon-carbon bonds. There are still carbon-hydrogen bonds that need to be picked apart if you want to get all the usable energy you can out of what was originally a glucose. And that's what cellular respiration allows for. And that's why it is definitely worth doing if you're the type of cell that has the ability to respire. You want to take, at the fork in the road, you want to take the respiration route if possible, because that's going to give you a lot more ATP payoff for what was originally that one glucose molecule. If you take the fermentation route, you don't get any more ATP, right? You're stuck with the 2 that you made from glycolysis, but at least fermentation allows you to undergo glycolysis with new glucose, assuming it's available. All right, so cellular respiration, according to me, even though it's slightly different in this book, begins where glycolysis ends. And whereas glycolysis occurs in the cytoplasm, cellular respiration occurs in the mitochondrion, assuming we're talking about a eukaryotic cell. By the way, there are plenty of respiring prokaryotes. Some of them aerobic, some of them anaerobic, but they undergo cellular respiration even though they don't have a mitochondrion. That's accomplished simply by the only membrane they have. So instead of the membrane that's necessary, like I said, for respiration being a mitochondrial membrane, in a bacterium's case, an aerobic bacterium's case, the membrane that electrons get moved across is the plasma membrane, the only membrane it has. We're going to focus, though, on how this happens in a eukaryote. So pyruvate, there are 2 of them, recall, from the original glucose. Those pyruvates now, though, we're going to individually concern ourselves with. So a pyruvate molecule, in order to be used as fuel itself, needs to be sent to the mitochondrion, which is why you see it going through both of the 2 membranes that a mitochondrion has. Remember, it's a doubly membrane-bounded organelle, the mitochondrion. That's really the beginning of cellular respiration, the entry of pyruvate into the mitochondrion. And upon entry of the pyruvate into the mitochondrion, it will undergo the first of 3 major steps of cellular respiration. Okay, so I break cellular respiration down into 3 major components. The first of which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Okay? Now think about what that phrase oxidative decarboxylation means. It means there's oxidation that's occurring, right? So that means you should get some energy out of that pyruvate, right? Because other oxidations that had happened earlier have yielded energy in the form of what? When you oxidized the fuel in glycolysis, what got reduced? NAD plus into NADH. So, right? You oxidize your fuels to get the energy out of them because that allows you to then reduce the coenzymes, which is now carrying those energetic electrons from the fuel. So, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate is an oxidation step, and therefore, as you see, produces a reduced coenzyme, NADH. But it's also a decarboxylation. What is a carboxyl group consist of? Right, carbon and two oxygens, right? Well, a decarboxylation means you're stripping off a carbon and two oxygens, and what comes out in the process? Carbon dioxide, right? Which you see right there. So, pyruvate, which starts out as a three-carbon compound, entering the mitochondrion, gets stripped of one of those carbons. So this first part of cellular respiration continues the dismantling of the carbon skeleton by the fact that it's a decarboxylation. But it's also oxidative, so you're storing some of the energy that was originally in that glucose, but now was in this pyruvate, in the form of reduced NADH. All right, that's the first part of cellular respiration. Well, what does that leave when you take one of the carbons and two oxygens from the pyruvate? You now have, of course, a two-carbon compound. It's not just two carbons, but there are two carbons in it, right? And so what you have after the decarboxylation is acetate. That acetate still is valuable fuel. It is not yet completely dismantled, right? It still has a carbon skeleton. It still has carbon-hydrogen bonds. So it doesn't have as much fuel as the pyruvate did because you've dismantled it a little bit further. But it can still be dismantled. There's still some energy to be had in that acetate. So the acetate needs to be sent to the second major step of cellular respiration. And that is the citric acid cycle, which eponymously can be called the Krebs cycle, which isn't too helpful because all it does is tell you the dead dude it's named after. But you can call it the citric acid cycle, you can call it the Krebs cycle, or you can call it the tricarboxylic acid cycle, or the TCA cycle for short. All of those really mean the same thing. It's listed as the citric acid cycle here. That's the second major phase of cellular respiration. All right? Well, acetate doesn't get delivered to the citric acid cycle on its own. It needs to be carried there by a coenzyme. Notice that the NAD that we've been calling a coenzyme is also carrying things from one place to another. They're carrying electrons from the fuel, and we'll talk about where they're going to dump them in a minute. All right? Well, similarly, you need a coenzyme to pick up the acetate that's left after the decarboxylation of pyruvate and deliver it to this second major phase of cellular respiration, the citric acid cycle. That coenzyme is coenzyme A. And supposedly the A of coenzyme actually refers to acetate. In any case, coenzyme A exists in, just like NAD, exists as an empty or a full taxi. Coenzyme A by itself is not carrying anything. But when you hook on the acetate that's left from pyruvate being decarboxylated, you have acetyl coenzyme A. All right? That is the output of the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which is step one of cellular respiration. Shouldn't really say step. I should say major phases, because there's multiple steps in each phase. Anyway, acetyl coenzyme A is, you can really just think of that as an acetate that is being, that has gotten picked up by coenzyme A so that it can drive it over to the citric acid cycle and drop it off, drop off the acetate. Now, the citric acid cycle, phase two of cellular respiration, accomplishes the complete oxidation of the fuel that remains. It completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton. It gets all of the usable energy out of what is left of the fuel. All right? And not surprisingly, since acetate, a two-carbon compound, is entering the cycle, a complete dismantling would mean that you're going to turn that one two-carbon compound into two one-carbon compounds, right? So CO2, notice, is produced by the citric acid cycle, a couple of them. Well, at that point, in terms of carbons, you've turned the original fuel molecule, glucose, into nothing but six CO2s. Right? Because there was a CO2 lost at the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. There's going to be two more in the citric acid cycle for a total of three. But that happens twice, once for each of the two pyruvates that glycolysis spit out. So that's your six CO2s. And CO2, as far as fuel is concerned, is worthless. It doesn't have any more usable energy in it. So the citric acid cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel. It's not the end of the process, though, because the goal, in a sense, is the production, the storing of as much energy from that fuel as possible in the form of ATP. And we haven't made all that much ATP yet. We made a little bit in glycolysis. We're going to make a little bit more in the citric acid cycle. But notice what else the citric acid cycle spits out. NADH and FADH2. More reduced coenzymes, in other words. And just keep remembering that each reduced coenzyme molecule is carrying more energy in it than an ATP. So multiple ATPs can be made eventually from the energy that each reduced coenzyme is carrying. Therefore, even though the fuel has been completely spent at this point, there's still more ATP to be made because you have not used the majority of that stored fuel, that stored energy, which is in the form of reduced coenzymes. Well, that's why the citric acid cycle is not the end of the process. There's the third major phase of cellular respiration after the citric acid cycle. And that overall third phase is called oxidative phosphorylation. All right. Now, the phosphorylation here refers, of course, to something getting phosphates added to them. What is it that gets phosphorylated in oxidative phosphorylation? ADP, exactly. That's where the final big payoff is in terms of ATP. Because when you phosphorylate ADP, you're producing ATP. Right? This is where you use this temporarily stored energy in the form of reduced coenzymes in order to phosphorylate ADP molecules into ATP. And you'll end up making a hell of a lot more ATP than the two net that you earned simply by glycolysis. That's why it's worth respiring. Okay? Now, that third overall phase, even though it's part three, has two major components to it that work hand in hand. Anyone know the two components of oxidative phosphorylation? Well, what part of cellular respiration, because you've all had this before, remember? What part of cellular respiration have we not even mentioned?
Electron
transport. That's one of the subphases of oxidative phosphorylation, or one of the components. The other, besides electron transport, is called chemiosmosis. Okay? And here's where it's important to remember that gradients are stored energy. Okay? So, electron transport accomplishes by transporting electrons from protein complex to protein complex, or from particle to particle, I should say, that uses the energy in the form of electrons that were originally in glucose. But what does it use that energy for, the transfer of these electrons? To establish a gradient of what? Protons. In other words, when you establish a gradient, what are you doing to those protons? When you're making the gradient steeper, or you're creating the gradient, what are you doing? Yeah, active transport, which can also be called what? Pumping, right. That's what electron transport directly accomplishes. It uses the energy carried by the electrons that came off of the fuel to pump protons from one side of the membrane to the other, creating a gradient. All right? So remember, up to this point, after phase two, after the citric acid cycle, the only usable energy that you have that was originally in glucose and that is not already in the form of ATP is in the form of reduced coenzymes, right? Those coenzymes lose their energy when they dump their electrons off, when they get rid of their passengers. Well, that's what they do at the electron transport chain. The electron transport chain receives electrons from the reduced coenzymes. So now you don't have energy in the form of reduced coenzymes anymore. That energy now is going to be spent by transferring electrons from one member to the next in this chain. That's what spends that energy, which is most of the usable energy, because you haven't made much ATP. But what that accomplishes is the establishment of a proton gradient. By transferring these electrons from member to member, that allows those members to act as pumps, proton pumps. So now you don't have any usable energy in the form of reduced coenzymes. Instead, the energy is in the form of a proton gradient, which always think of as being a form of potential energy. Okay? That's the electron transport component of oxidative phosphorylation. The final payoff, then, is to use that gradient to do some work for you. That's what chemiosmosis is. Chemiosmosis, which has nothing to do with osmosis of water. Chemiosmosis refers to the diffusion of hydrogen ions, or protons, down their gradient, back across the membrane, but the way they want to go, down their gradient. And that uses the energy that you have left. And if that's all that you allowed was them to diffuse back in, all you would do is produce heat. But the big payoff is the chemiosmosis part of it. These protons are going to diffuse back to where they got pumped from originally, but in the process, they're going to turn membrane-bound proteins in this mitochondrial inner membrane that act as enzymes and get activated as enzymes by turning, and that has the effect of phosphorylating ADP, creating ATP. Okay? So that's the phosphorylation aspect of oxidative phosphorylation. That wouldn't happen unless you have something turning your mill in a sense. Just like I said that pouring the water over the water wheel can grind the corn, Well, allowing these protons to trickle back through the membrane at just the right places will turn these enzymes, allowing them to operate as phosphorylating enzymes, turning ADP into ATP. Then you have as many ATPs as you can make from the energy that's usable from what was originally glucose. All right, those are the three major steps. Oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, tricarboxylic acid cycle, oxidative phosphorylation. And by the way, oxidative phosphorylation is a different way of phosphorylating compared to the phosphorylation that's taken place up to this point. There was some ATP that was made in glycolysis. There's some ATP that's made at the citric acid cycle. Those phosphorylation events are classified as what kind of phosphorylation? Anyone know? Substrate level phosphorylation, those are called, yes. They're called substrate level phosphorylation because what happens is that an enzyme will take phosphate from something that already has it on it, and that thing that's phosphorylated at the moment is a substrate because it's binding to the enzyme, and that phosphate will be stripped from the one thing and put on to the other thing, namely ADP, making it into ATP. Okay, that's substrate level phosphorylation. In oxidative phosphorylation, which occurs in the final phase of cellular respiration, it's inorganic phosphate that gets hooked on to ADP. And that doesn't happen unless these proteins are turning, like I said, which doesn't happen unless the protons are diffusing. So that's a different way of phosphorylating. You see that happening right here. These are the ATP synthase molecules, which are the names of the protein complexes that spin in response to the diffusion of hydrogen ions. Yeah.
So why would you power the protein complex or the protein mechanism directly with ATP? Like, why would you even bother with this?
Because the goal is to produce ATP, not to spend it. Okay. And in fact, I'm glad you brought this up, though, because these are reversible. If you wanted to spend ATP instead of making it, you could reverse this process, spend ATP to spin these in the opposite direction, and pump protons instead of allowing them to fuse through. And they're actually used that way in some cells. This is analogous to reversing a motor, right? You can have a generator. A generator is the same thing as a motor, really. Except a generator is turning in one direction to produce electricity, whereas a motor is using electricity to turn. Okay, let's also remind ourselves before we leave this first slide that the multiple membranes, the two membranes of a mitochondrion, means that it's compartmentalized into two major compartments, right? There is the intermembrane space, which is the space, of course, between the two membranes, outer and inner membrane. And that intermembrane space is more or less continuous with what some books will call the intercrystal space. Notice that's all one compartment. But then you will have a totally different compartment because it's separated by that inner membrane, and that innermost compartment, fully inside both membranes, is the mitochondrial matrix. All right, so it's the mitochondrial matrix where cellular respiration takes place. The bulk of cellular respiration takes place in the matrix. Some of it officially it takes place actually in the membrane itself, the inner membrane. But inside the mitochondrion is where all of it occurs. Okay, now to two. Well, we've already talked about the basic anatomy of a mitochondria, and you're seeing it again. The inner membrane, even though it's inside the outer membrane, is actually a lot more membrane. It's roughly five times the surface area of the outer membrane because of the prominent folds in it that we call the Christi, or Christa for singular. And that's the whole idea of the crista, or each crista, is to maximize the surface area. The more surface area you have, the more membrane you have, the more proteins that you can house in that membrane. And in this case, there's more proteins in this membrane than there are in any of the other membranes in the cell. And that's because these various kinds of proteins are the players in the game that accomplish the various steps of cellular respiration. So the more you more copies of those you can have in there, the more this can happen efficiently. You know, we usually use the phrase the electron transport chain, like there's one chain. Well, there's thousands and thousands of copies of it just in one mitochondrion. The more that's, and you can fit all of those because of the folds. That's the main point there. In slide 3, we can see that the mitochondrion, even though we kind of focus, at least in this course, on cellular respiration, that's not its only function. It has two membranes, of course, in different compartments. Well, different things happen at those different components. So phospholipid synthesis, fatty acid desaturation, meaning producing double bonds. These are other things that the mitochondrion does. Notice that that's involving the outer membrane. There's also, for instance, beta oxidation of fats. Notice it's listed here. That's because the mitochondrion is not concerned only with sugar fuels. Yeah, definitely sugars are important fuels, glucose among them, but others as well. Like we said, polysaccharides and other monosaccharides can all eventually feed into the glycolytic pathway, right? And glycerol, after you hydrolyze a fat into glycerol and free fatty acids, glycerol can feed into the glycolytic pathway like we talked about. But fatty acids of fats are major energy stores. And another major function of the mitochondrion is to use those fatty acids after they've been liberated from the fat, after they're no longer connected to the glycerol, in other words. Those are very useful sources of energy, just like pyruvate is. And so what we call the beta oxidation of fats is really accomplishes the same thing that the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate does. In oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which is part of cellular respiration, you take away a carbon to leave a 2-carbon acetate, right? Well, a fatty acid has some number of carbons in it. And if you just take those two at a time off of the chain, what you're taking away each time is an acetate group. So coenzyme A can pick up 2 carbons at a time from a fatty acid to produce the same thing, acetyl coenzyme A, that the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate does. And so that's how fatty acids have their big payoff. It doesn't matter at that point whether the acetyl coenzyme A is getting its acetate from beta oxidation or from oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. They both feed identically into the citric acid cycle and have a big payoff in terms of ATP synthesis. All right, let's look at 4. Now, I've given you, it took a long time to get through slide 1 because I gave you a major rundown or summary of the whole process of cellular respiration. Here we're looking at the two first phases. So in gray at the top, we see the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and we don't care here about, just for simplicity, we don't care about the oxygens or the hydrogens involved. We're just showing you, we're representing pyruvate as 3-carbon atoms because it's a 3-carbon compound at this point. There's a carbon skeleton made up of 3 carbons. And necessary for this step, since it's an oxidation, is something that can be reduced, right? That's why the two inputs into the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate are, of course, pyruvate itself, but also NAD+. All right? And coenzyme A by itself. All right? The empty taxi. Well, you have 2 empty taxis here, NAD+ and coenzyme A. One of those taxis is going to pick up electrons from the pyruvate. The other one is going to pick up the carbons that are left after you take one of them away. The decarboxylation step takes one of those carbons away along with two oxygens, which is why CO2 gets liberated at this point. So this is the first time that CO2 got produced. Remember that glycolysis doesn't produce any CO2. So you're only producing CO2 when you use your fuels if you are undergoing cellular respiration. All right? Which is why you produce CO2 in accordance to how much oxygen you're using, right? Because you use oxygen for cellular respiration. The CO2, though, comes from originally the food that you ate. It's just the energetically unusable scrap, the leftover of what was energetically valuable nutrients. Okay, that's the decarboxylation. Well, the electrons that get stripped from that pyruvate get hooked onto, electrons and proton, get hooked onto NAD+, of course, reducing it into NADH. Nothing new there, it's just a different part of the overall process that happens here with pyruvate. And it's the coenzyme A molecule that is the other empty taxi that picks up the leftover two carbons, which make up the acetate. Right? And that's why what you have now is acetyl coenzyme A, not just coenzyme A. In other words, coenzyme A with an acetate group or an acetyl group hooked to it. And look at the orange arrow that's next. This coenzyme A is doing its job of acting as a taxi to drive this acetate, this leftover fuel, to the next major phase, the citric acid cycle, which is the orange circle, of course. Now, the citric acid cycle, when you call it that, it's named for the fact that the first thing in that is produced by the cycle receiving this 2-carbon acetate from coenzyme A is citrate or citric acid. That's why it's called the citric acid cycle. All right? Notice that citrate is a 6-carbon compound. So it kind of seems like you're going backwards, because what we've been trying to accomplish here since glucose was the start is the dismantling of a carbon skeleton, right? That's how you get energy out of the fuel. Well, you've partially done that. You've dismantled it first into 2 pyruvates, and now each of those pyruvates is being dismantled further into an acetate. But now you're going to take this acetate that coenzyme A is dropping off to the citric acid cycle, and those 2 carbons are going to be added to 4 carbons, making up oxaloacetate, which is the end intermediate. If you consider the top of this circle, the start-finish line, oxaloacetate is the thing coming in at the finish line. And it's carrying 4 carbons in its skeleton. You add 2 more from acetate to produce citric acids, which is a 6-carbon compound. So that kind of seems like you're going in reverse, because now you're building up a carbon skeleton rather than dismantling it. But you're going to dismantle that then 1 carbon at a time, which has the effect, since it spits off 2 carbon dioxide molecules, of completing the dismantling of acetate, or accomplishing the dismantling of acetate, which completes the dismantling of the overall glucose that you started with. Does that all make sense? Does that not make sense? How many of you are apathetic? All right, well, that's why the cycle gets its name, from citrate, which is produced by oxaloacetate, a 4-carbon compound, receiving 2 more carbons from acetyl, the acetate that is connected to coenzyme A. Coenzyme A, though, is not in the citric acid cycle. Coenzyme A drops its cargo off. Those 2 carbons in the acetyl group it's carrying get dropped off, hooked on to oxaloacetate, make citrate. From there on, it is largely a rearrangement of things, except for these 2 dismantling steps that you see represented by the arrows that spit out CO2. So, the citric acid cycle, even though it has several steps, the importance in terms of what is trying to be accomplished here is that there are two decarboxylation steps, right? And that's what accomplishes the complete dismantling of the carbon skeleton, because by the time you have two more CO2s spit out, in addition to the one that you already spit out in the previous step, that's it, right? There were only three carbons to work with from that pyruvate. And just keep in mind, the same exact thing happens for the other pyruvate that came out of glycolysis. So not you don't even have to go all the way through the cycle to say that you're done dismantling the skeleton, even though, as we'll see, these carbons that are in these carbon dioxides are not actually the same ones that came in from pyruvate. They are from fuel, though, because they just came in from an earlier pyruvate. So there are two decarboxylation steps, but notice that there are four purple places here which represent reductions of coenzymes. So in other words, there's four oxidation steps. By oxidation, I'm talking about oxidation of the fuel, which are the intermediates in the cycle itself. But any oxidation, of course, is going to accompany a reduction. It's the NAD pluses that get reduced for three of these four oxidation steps. But we have a different taxi, a different coenzyme operating in one of these four, and that's FAD. So it's not NAD in all these cases, just three of the cases. Now, what does FAD stand for? Obviously, it's not adenine. It's not nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's something else, but the AD stands for the same things. Adenine dinucleotide. What's the F stand for? No, but it's a good guess. Flavin. So FAD is flavin adenine dinucleotide. And therefore, the only difference is what the nitrogenous base is in one of those two nucleotides, right? It was nicotinamide in NAD's case. It's flavin in FAD's case. All right? So this third of the four oxidation steps has to load the electrons that are being stripped from the fuel onto a different taxi, FAD instead of NAD+. But FADH2 and NADH, those are both carrying very useful energy that can pay off in terms of multiple ATPs eventually being produced in step 3, or phase 3, I should say. All right? Now, on the very bottom, notice that there is also a phosphorylation step. And just like in glycolysis, this is substrate-level phosphorylation. But I should point out that what is shown here is how this would occur in non-animals, meaning that ATP is directly produced by the citric acid cycle. In us animals, however, we don't use ADP to directly pick up the phosphate. Instead, we use GDP, guanosine diphosphate, which energetically is equal to ADP, and ATP is energetically equivalent to GTP. But anyway, in animals, it's indirect rather than being direct like it's shown here. So what happens in animals is that a GDP will get phosphorylated directly by the cycle, forming GTP, but then immediately that GTP hands its phosphate off to an ADP outside of the cycle. And so you end up making ATP either way. Just one extra step in animals. So that, by the time you're through all of these oxidation steps, and because of the decarboxylation, you're left with four carbons in the form of oxaloacetate. And that's the thing that comes to the finish line, the start-finish line, to get two more carbons added to it from another pyruvate that has been decarboxylated. and another acetyl coenzyme A that's carrying the two carbons that are left from pyruvate, making another citrate for another round through the cycle. So this just continues. But notice that each turn of it spits out two CO2s. That represents the complete dismantling of the fuel's carbon skeleton. That's why the only usable fuel at this point that was originally in glucose is in the form of the ATP produced by glycolysis, in the form of ATP produced by the citric acid cycle, in the form of NADH produced by glycolysis, in the form of NADH produced by the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, in the form of NADH produced by the citric acid cycle, and in the form of FADH2 produced by the citric acid cycle. In other words, the only energy that you have that's usable and that's not already in the form of ATP is in the form of reduced coenzymes, NADH and FADH2. But those several reduced coenzymes that are produced for each individual glucose can now pay off big time in terms of creating a lot more ATP in the final or third phase of cellular respiration, oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, let's go to 5 and and look at this relationship between coenzyme A and acetate. The shading here, the gray shading, shows you the carbon and oxygens involved in the decarboxylation. So that's why you have CO2 being liberated. The rest of this, though, the two carbons and the oxygen and hydrogens make up the acetate, which is now going to be hooked on to coenzyme A. Well, coenzyme A, as an empty taxi, is often represented as CoA-SH. Sometimes it's just CoA. But the CoA-SH notation is important because it reminds us of how, of what the actual business end of this molecule is. The SH is what kind of group? It's a sulfhydryl group. Very similar to a hydroxyl group, except sulfur instead of oxygen, right? That is the carrying end of this molecule. That's the point of attachment between coenzyme A and the thing that it's carrying. Well, when we call it an empty taxi, all it's carrying is a hydrogen on that sulfur. That hydrogen, though, is going to be popped off so that it can pick up its cargo, the 2-carbon acetate that remains after the decarboxylation of pyruvate. So we see that bond right here. No hydrogen there anymore. And so now, this is not just coenzyme A. This is acetyl coenzyme A. And it can drive that 2-carbon compound to the citric acid cycle. 6. Well, coenzyme A is shown here in full detail in terms of all the atoms involved. And one thing that you can see here is that it's another use of an RNA nucleotide, right? Adenine, ribose, phosphate, that is, right, a nucleotide. You recognize that as the same thing that's part of RNA and the same thing that's part of ATP. But hooked to that phosphate is what's in the reddish rectangle here, pantothenic acid, which is an important vitamin for us because we can't produce this on our own, so we have to get it from something that produces it for us by eating them. Well, anyway, at the very tip of this, after the pantothenic acid, the very top part where you see the sulfhydryl group, that is the part that makes this a useful carrier of cargo. The sulfhydryl group is what allows the connection to be made between coenzyme A and the acetate group. And notice that when that forms, when the hydrogen is lost from the sulfhydryl and the acetate gets stuck on instead, that forms what's called a thioester group. Now, if this were just an ordinary ester, you would have a COC, right, which would occur if you had a hydroxyl instead of a sulfhydryl. You would have a C there, O, and then a C. That would be an ester. This is called a thioester, though, because thio means sulfur. So it's just like an ester using sulfur instead of oxygen. So instead of having COC, you have CSC. That's the connection point between coenzyme A and its cargo. All right, I'll stop.